Saw the blue light. We're on. Good morning, everyone. I'd like to welcome everyone here, the second half of our meeting, Senate Interim Committee on Veterans Affairs. With my colleague, Representative Cowan, I'd like to call the meeting to order.
And we have returned from recess.
Absolutely. This is largely an informational meeting this morning. Basically, we're going to start out with invited testimony, really finalizing the three reports that we have pulled together during the interim, the transportation to assistance piece for veterans to access health care, the task force on women's veterans health care, and finally, the report of the reintegration task force. I want to thank all the members of the committee who worked so diligently. I do know that we have come up with a number of placeholder bills that we will continue to flesh out and more than likely discuss in December. So to get us started, I'd like to call up, Director Willis, I think, is here this morning. And then the folks, I think it's Mr. Warren, who worked on the veterans transportation piece. Good morning. And if you can help lead us through the final draft of the work that you've done during the interim, that would be helpful for the committee. Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chairs, and members of the committee and professional staff. For the record, my name is Jim Willis. I'm director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. And I want to begin this morning by thanking all the members of the task force and certainly all the members of these two joint committees for your support of this work that we have completed. I also want to publicly thank Tom Mann, who is my public information manager, for staffing these task forces and to the rest of our staff for preparing some very professional reports. I would be remiss without thanking the chairs of the three task forces, two of whom are with us today, we only have one today because one's traveling, and I think we might have sickness involved with the other one. But in any event, you'll hear the full reports. And to help move that along and to join Mike up here as we begin the report with the Veterans Transportation Task Force, I'm going to ask Tom Mann to come up, and then he'll walk through the rest of the testimony as they're needed. And then, of course, we'll be prepared to close with the report on the second Veterans Hall. So if that will work for the two chairs, we can start like that.
Great.
Okay, thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Schrader and Chair Cowan and members of the committees. For the record, I'm Michael Ward. I served as the chair of the Task Force on Veterans Transportation, and my day job is the administrator of the Public Transit Division with ODOT. And so it was a very nice overlap, helped me get a better understanding of some of the issues our veterans face around transportation, and so it was a real pleasure for me to serve on service chair. I would echo some of Jim's comments in terms of thanking the members who chose to serve on our task force. The legislative initiative that began this process specified five state agencies. In addition to those agencies, we wrestled up a large crowd of very sincere and committed folks who were diligent about meeting with us about every 6 weeks, trying to work through the issues that we identified. We had folks from VA, representatives from the DAV, and a number of public transit providers who pitched in and lent their expertise in trying to resolve some of the issues that we discovered. I also want to let you know that one of the first things that we knew was that even though there's lots of issues out there, we had to focus our energies and look for solutions to that we could implement fairly quickly that affected our most vulnerable veterans, whether they be elderly or severely disabled. So some of our recommendations really focus on that subsection of veterans and their transportation issues. Also, as you'll see in the recommendations, that a lot of our recommendations will function or will be put in place sort of outside the legislative process. It relies on better communications between various organizations, both federal and state, and within state government, better coordination and communication between various state agencies. And the task force was a good way to start some of those relationships, get some of those partnerships started in, and there's a real sense that we'll certainly continue those relationships and continue working these issues as even after the final report is presented. As you may have noticed, I'm not going to read this to you. I'm sort of walking through it. I don't want to insult you with that. But the bottom line as we address this issue was it's kind of a straightforward issue. How do we get the vets to where their medical needs are, or can we get the medical services to where the vets are? And you'll see in our recommendations, we attack that issue from both those perspectives. And lastly, before I talk about the recommendations, just let you know that even at the federal level, the federal VA has a task force or a committee working on transportation issues, especially in rural parts of the country. It's a really a daunting challenge to get some of our veterans who live in rural parts of Oregon or rural parts of the state to medical care that tends to be centralized in urban areas. It's a real issue for us. We had a number of recommendations. I'm not going to read them all. Sort of cherry pick and highlight them for you. Certainly be available for your questions about any of those. But a number of the recommendations talk about improved communication and improved coordination between various organizations. And I would draw your attention to two examples. Recommendation 12 that talks about our public transit human services coordinated transportation plan. Oh, I was about to say, as most of you know, but I'm used to addressing our transportation committees, so let me back up. As the Public Transit Division Administrator, we coordinate the state transportation program, which is a special transportation fund. We distribute that money primarily to counties or large public transit agencies. We require them to receive the funds to have a coordinated plan in place to show us how they will be using the funds and how they address the transportation needs of elderly and disabled in their communities. Well, what we discovered in this task force was that a number of our veterans coordinators around the state didn't realize that fund existed and who in their county was what we call the STF coordinator. So one of the first things we did was close that communication gap. And so I would be very surprised if in our next go round of the distribution of those funds, we don't see counties coming forward with projects that either primarily or secondarily address veterans transportation issues in their communities, simply because they were able to make that connection with the special transportation fund coordinator in their county, get those needs entered into their plan, and now they're eligible to receive funding from us to try to address those issues. Now, I will say that, as you're well aware, much more need than funds available. It's a competitive process within the counties on what projects get funded. They have a public process. Low income are represented. Our elderly and disabled advocates are there also. But I'm hoping that now that we've built that link between the veterans coordinator and the STF coordinator in the county, that we'll see some coordination and we'll see some projects that target our veterans transportation issues. But just an example of trying to improve our coordination and our communication between similar organizations. And recommendation 14 is the same way. The Veterans Advisory Council is really an extension of this task force, trying to solidify and continue the good work that this task force has done and build on the relationships that have already been developed. And as we continue to work on veterans transportation issues through the Department of Transportation, Human Services, employment, and continue those fine works. One of the other recommendations I would point to is The first one, create a fund within the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. I hate to do this. I know that one of the obvious solutions that you probably hear a lot of is we just need more money and then our problems go away. But we really don't have any funding specifically targeted for some of our most vulnerable veterans and their transportation needs. Getting from rural Oregon to major urban areas for medical appointments is a real, real hardship. And there's several issues that get in the way of being able to do that. Trying to find a small dedicated funding a source that would help with the purchase of handicap accessible vehicles would be just one element of trying to help solve that problem. And that leads us to a recommendation two. I've already done that. There are several federal grant programs we've applied for, and baked into those applications are funds, I should know this, several hundred thousand dollars asking for funds for us to buy public transit division, to buy handicap accessible vehicles, then that we would work with the Veterans Administration and DAV on how we could leverage that investment and those vehicles into the current network. So we're already working on that, as we are working on several of these recommendations. The other highlight that came out of our task force, and that I'd really like to spend just a few minutes with you on, and it's sort of outlined in the last paragraph, the public transit community over the last decade has built a fairly robust infrastructure around scheduling and providing special need rides. We call them brokerages. They sort of serve as a broker for rides. Some clients are able to have their ride paid for by one Medicare program. One client might have their ride paid by another DHS service. And so they act as brokers to try to facilitate arranging special need rides for those individuals in their communities to either medical appointments or shopping or critical life, quality of life kinds of issues. We've been doing that for about 10 years now. I think that's about right. And we've become very, very good at that. But what we found when we did this task force is we don't do a lot of that with our veterans. And so one of the things that we have identified early on and are actively working on is a pilot project with the federal VA where we use one of our brokerages, and this is the one up in Representative Boone's area, Cindy Howe with Sunset Empire, who's volunteered to take this on, to see how we could leverage that initial investment and provide rides for our veterans, whether it's from Astoria, St. Helens area, into Portland for their medical rides, or other kinds of services they might need. We're trying to arrange a meeting with several of Washington, D.C. VA reps in October 18th, 19th timeframe to get their support for the pilot so that we can begin this proof of concept, identify where there are some bugs. There's always some bugs on the financial end. How do we get are those veterans eligible for some transportation-related reimbursements? Can we have that money transferred to the brokerages or the applicable public transit provider, as we do with the other agencies that we work with? But there is a significant and very well lubricated process out there to get people from where they are to where they need to go, and it just doesn't make sense to any of us that we somehow don't incorporate our veterans into those processes. So we're working on that actually as we speak. Hope to have a pilot up and running, if not by the end of the year, shortly thereafter, and then probably after 6 months or so, be able to sit down with the federal VA and work through what some of those issues are that we discovered and how do we resolve those. But a real potential use of our existing folks to solve some of our needs. As I mentioned in my opening comments, we can get the veteran to where they need to go, where we can get medical services to where the veterans are. That's recommendation 9 in terms of trying to encourage. We use the verb encourage, you know, as much as we can, the federal VA to look at how to expand medical services and other services in their community-based output outpatient clinics and telemedicine and other technological advances that bring the service to the veteran versus moving the veteran to where the service is, and we want to encourage them to do more of that. Let's see. I think with that, I'm going to step back. I think I've outlined the major things that we're focusing on. I do want to reinforce that even though the final report will be done sometime in October, we plan on continuing the work of the task force, transitioning into the Veterans Advisory Council, and continue working on several of these issues that require the continued development and nurturing of the relationships that we have in place, so that we make sure that we're following through on some of these recommendations that we've made. So with that, let me shut up. And because I can go on, and because it was a great group of folks, very needed task force, lots of gaps out there that we're really hoping to fill, especially with some of our most needed Oregonians. So, be happy to entertain any questions any of the committees might have for me. Thank you.
Thank you for your work and your testimony, and I colleagues, I'll open it up for questions. I do have a few myself, but I would like to see if anyone else. I think Representative Cowan, you'd like to make a comment.
Thank you, and Madam Chair, and I maybe can focus this a little bit this morning because of our time constraints. I want to first acknowledge to all three of the task forces who are reporting today that when those task forces were developed and we gave you an October 1 timeline for bringing a report back to us, we weren't aware that we were going to have a little bit different structure in the timelines, at least on the House side, for submitting bills being September 27th. So I know that we have pushed you into a rather difficult position, and I'm looking forward to the full report. I was very encouraged about many of the things you said today about how so much of what you're looking at is already being done, can be done in-house, offline. It's carrying forward the goal that we've had of improving communications between our various agencies and focusing some of the more particular needs of veterans within each of those other agency conversations. So what the question I have, and it may be more for Tom Mann, you can hand it off if you wish, if maybe just for the committee's understanding, if you could kind of flag out of these recommendations which of them you are considering that we need to get a placeholder bill working and that we can then look at developing more fully into a bill at some point, as opposed to just continuing cooperative efforts.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Mann for the record. I'm with the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. Thank you for the opportunity to even meet with you early to talk about these bills, because we did have some meetings. There was one joint memorial we're going to ask the legislature to consider as a committee bill that talks about mandating VA to reimburse transportation costs to private facilities. When you read the executive summary and you read the full report, which will be to you on October 1st, one of the issues we've had is if a veteran has an emergency and goes to his local hospital in his community, the law states that as soon as that veteran is stabilized, they have to be transported to a VA if they want the VA to pay for that care. What happens is the hospital, and in the example of St. Charles Hospital in Bend, was transporting veterans to the VA in Portland, but that transportation cost was never reimbursed. And what the law says is in certain circumstances the veteran can be reimbursed for travel, but the law is kind of moot regarding how a facility that transports a veteran in an emergency situation to the VA as per the law gets reimbursed. So we wanted to have Congress take a look at that and amend that law so that these facilities, our local hospitals who are transporting veterans, can be reimbursed legally for their transportation cost. Everything else you'll see in the recommendations, we believe we can do through our strategic partnerships and with the congressional delegation who also were involved in the task force.
I'd like to do a follow-up with that. So, for instance, when we talk a little bit about the county plans for disabled folks, so in your opinion, that outcome in terms of getting, making sure the counties have veterans as part of their transportation plan for the for disabled folks, it's not going to necessarily need a placeholder bill at all or anything that, you know, mandates, because I saw the word mandate and the first thing that came to my mind is that meaning that we have to come up with a bill, or can we just depend on these systems to continue working together?
Chair Schrader, members of the committee, when I edited this document, I took that word out specifically and changed it to ensure, because the current STF statutes are very clear and don't need modification in terms of the public transit and human service coordinated transportation plan. Those are in place. We have good representation from advocates of the elderly, advocates for the disabled, advocates for low income, involved in those public processes that help create those plans, that help lay out and work through the process on what projects that get selected and ultimately end up on my desk for approval and funding. What this just points out is there was a gap in making sure that our veterans coordinators around the state knew about that process, and therefore here was another potential funding source for some of those projects. So the mandate, the word mandate is probably inappropriate here. It's just to ensure that they're aware of this, and we've already done taken steps to do that.
A follow-up question with 14 as well. So establishing a Veterans Advisory Council, again, is that something that we need to officially move forward with, or is that something that pretty much we can depend on this group to continue to meet together? So,
Madam Chair, when we had a discussion about that, that council is kind of tied to how the new governor comes in and looks at veterans issues, because the idea was to have executive sponsorship of that idea, to have executive agencies sit on a council and coordinate veteran issues that intersect all the agencies. And the decision was made that it would be better to wait till the new governor comes in and have those discussions with the governor and their policy advisors to determine how best to go about that coordination and deconfliction.
Thank you. Colleagues, any other questions?
I think we have our legislative direction and make sure that we more thoroughly look at the reports at follow-up meetings.
Well, what I'm hearing, again, to follow up as well, is that 13 will be a bill draft, and that's memorializing Congress. So specifically right now, based on this preliminary draft, which we will have finalized by October 1st, this seems to be the only actual tangible legislation that's going to move forward. But this task force, but the other pieces will fall into place with existing resources and existing systems that are out there. The only other thing I see is potentially number one, create fund within the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs to pay for transportation costs. Certainly we could do a placeholder, but I would suspect that given the economic climate, it would be something that we just keep.
Madam Chair, we actually had a placeholder on the April 15th due date, and so there's an LC rumbling around somewhere, but I didn't have much hope for it based upon the economic climate.
I guess my direction would be it doesn't hurt to have a draft and have that in a back pocket as we move on in the future and economic conditions improve. Certainly that should continue to be a priority. Okay. Any other questions? Yes, Representative.
Then couldn't you also just do it and fund it with $1? And, you know, to open it, basically, and then when things tone down a little bit, put some money in it.
We'll move that placeholder forward.
Okay. I think that would be a good, absolutely an excellent idea. Right. Let's just keep that open. Thank you for that. Thank you, Mr. Warren. It's great to have you here, and thank you for all your hard work. I was going to ask Mr. Mann. to stay put because I think we're going to have Elon Lambert join him. The next overview is going to be the Task Force on Women's Veterans Healthcare. And I do want to make a comment. I had the opportunity to attend the opening of the Women's VA Center at Veterans Affairs the other day, and it was quite a remarkable day. So, good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chairs and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Alon Lambert, and I have been a participant on the Legislative Task Force on Women Veterans Healthcare, so I'm representing the task force today. I'm also a Vietnam-era vet and do use the VA services. So the task force had 8 members and 20 participants. You can imagine we had a variety of extremely dynamic and complex issues related to women veterans health care. We visited Oregon's 3 major VA facilities, had the opportunity to speak with and hear from women veterans. And on the task force, we had 4 subject matter experts from the VA, either as members or as participating with the task force. And that in the end, we believe that between improvements being made by the VA and recommendations held within the task force final report, that women veterans in Oregon will receive quality, gender-specific, and appropriate health care in a safe and caring environment. And what I would like to do is to just touch a little bit on a couple of the findings. First of all, as will be stated in our report, there's approximately 341,000 veterans in Oregon, of which 25,103 are women, which is 7.4%. And at present, only 29%, or 7,361 of these women veterans use the VA services. And knowing that we have many more women veterans that are serving, that those numbers are going to be going up over the period of time. One of the things that I would like to stress in the findings is that there's an insufficient number of women healthcare providers within the VA system to meet the needs of women veterans, and we women veterans have unique gender-specific needs. So that there's actually a need for safe, gender-specific, inpatient, acute, specialized, and residential treatment beds for women veterans in Oregon. And in the VA, there are currently no women specialized inpatient treatment beds for PTSD and military sexual trauma in VISN 20. And as a veteran with military sexual trauma, I can tell you that I was hospitalized in 1997, all those 13 years ago. I was the only female on the psychiatric unit and was re-traumatized on that unit based on being the only female there. So I have personal understanding of the need for gender-specific for women-only veterans to be able to get their health care. One of the things as far as the transportation needs is it's very difficult for women veterans who've been traumatized to sit in an enclosed vehicle for hours with male veterans. I can tell you for myself, even to go into the mental health clinic at the VA and sit in the waiting room, even 35 years later after I had military sexual trauma, I still have a hard time sitting in that lobby area because there's only one way in and one way out, basically. And so it's not something that goes away over a period of time. You have to manage it, but I just want to have the committees to understand that this is an issue that's very specific and can be a very difficult one to deal with. And that there's really a cultural competence is lacking in a lot of the caregivers from the VA and from other outside places about the needs of women veterans and what it is that we need. Another issue for women veterans, if they come to appointments, that they have children. They need a place to have child care. And so I know that the new facility is addressing some of those issues, but there are quite a few things that need to take place for us women veterans. So the task force came up with 12 recommendations, and basically is to create dedicated specialized inpatient treatment beds for women veterans suffering from post-traumatic stress, disorder, military sexual trauma, and or substance abuse in VISN 20, which I believe includes Oregon, Washington, Idaho, and Alaska. So we don't have any specific in all those areas. Increase the dedicated acute psychiatric beds and residential beds for women veterans in VISN 20. We'd also like to obtain and staff a mobile health care unit for women veterans to be used in rural and remote Oregon and Southwest Washington. we think that would be a great idea to be able to have women veterans to be able to be seen where they can actually go out to those areas instead of having to come into the, whether it be Portland or Roseburg or what city. To allow victims of military sexual trauma to seek mental health counseling and care with a provider of their choice at VA expense so that you may not have to come into the Portland VA or the other VAs to get help. Increase the number of qualified providers who provide gender-specific care within the Veterans Health Administration system. Require every vet center, community-based outpatient clinic, and VA hospital to have a sufficient number of proficient, interested, and engaged military sexual trauma counselors to meet the increasing needs of women veterans. I also personally feel that we need to have every county veteran service officer needs to be aware of women's issues, particularly with military sexual trauma. We also want to encourage the Veterans Health Administration to export knowledge and expertise on women veterans' health care to private and public sectors through continuing and professional education classes. We want to require the Veterans Health Administration to fully fund women veterans' health care initiatives and mandates, including gender-specific mental health services and recruitment of women health primary care providers. We want them to recognize that explicit resources are required to transform the VA to meet women veterans' service needs as defined in the VA policy. And the VA actually has a uniform code that was put into place in, I believe, in 2008. It was supposed to take place in 2009, and many of the places do not meet those policy requirements as of yet. Require continuing education in military sexual trauma for all licensed medical providers, counselors, and social workers, and encourage all medical and social service curricula to include instructions on military sexual trauma. Create a social networking and public awareness campaign on women veterans' health care to reach women veterans of all areas and all parts of Oregon. We'd also like to see a 1-800 military sexual trauma hotline and also a women veterans warm line, and work with the Oregon Congressional Delegation to support stable or increased TRICARE reimbursement rates. And so some of these will actually be before the body's legislation, and others will work outside the legislature with VA partners and the Oregon Congressional Delegation, which has obviously been a key player in all of our meetings. And so I've been asked to speak for Chair Nancy Visser and the rest of the task force members that we've been very grateful to be able to have this task force to look at the women's issues, and that we look forward to the next session so that we can see some of these things taking place. So if there's any questions, I'll be happy to answer them.
Colleagues, any questions? About Representative Cowan, then Representative Boone.
Well, just to sort of focus us again, thank you, Madam Chair. This happens to be the task force that I was fortunate enough to participate with. And correct me if I'm missing something, Tom, but I believe that recommendations number 3 and 4, we're proposing a joint memorial, and are anticipating some sort of bill introduction to address numbers 9, 10, and 11.
Correct.
Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. Hey, Representative Boone.
That answers my question. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Tom, could you give me a kind of an update of the status of the veterans facility in Lane County, Springfield specifically? I understand there's been some reversal of decisions and so on.
Well, we are actually going to we are going to actually be addressing that after we go through Senator the reports.
Oh, good.
If you don't mind.
Oh no, no.
Okay, because we will be talking about that. Yes, Mr.
Oh, I'm sorry. I see this on the agenda. Yeah. I didn't notice that.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I've been working with Tom Mann to get these LCs in, particularly with the different deadlines. At one point, we thought it was April. And then it became the 27th of the House. I understand it's now October 7th for the Senate. So to make sure we didn't have anything fall between the cracks, we've been periodically sending LC requests to Legislative Council's office.
And thank you for that.
It doesn't mean they're being introduced. It just means they're being drafted.
Right, and that was my next question. Now, we have been directed for the record, even though our official date is now moved to October in the Senate, many of us are attempting to stick to work with the House and try and stick to that September deadline. So even though we have a little bit more fudge room, and I guess my question would be, what do we have any specific legislation, Mr. Mann, coming out of this report? I mean, do we have placeholders already in place? And if so, what are they?
Madam Chair, let me reiterate what Chair Cowan said. We do have five bills, and it's a joint memorial for the mobile healthcare bus.
I heard that.
A joint memorial for allowing military sexual trauma payment by VA outside of the VA system. A bill continuing outreach to women veterans by ODVA Military Department. A bill allowing ODVA to explore creating a military sexual trauma hotline. And then we're still working on the idea of how to get the knowledge base of the VA exported into the community. And so that's some language we're working on for this task force. Other recommendations, we will continue to work behind the scenes with our congressional delegation and our partners. One of the wonderful things that have happened from these task forces is strategic partnerships we've never had before, or strengthening of partnerships, allowing us to do a lot of things where we would usually have to come to the legislature, now we can do outside of the legislature.
Yes, and thank you for clarifying. I was in a little bit of a side conversation here. So my understanding from at least Ms. Lambert's report, it's number 3, number 4, 9, 10, and 11, and we'll just earmark those. And Senator Boquist, I think you had a comment.
I just have a follow-up question to the administrator and to Bill. Are we in the process of the LCs for the one or two items on the transportation side, too? We specifically mentioned item 13, Memorialized Congress. Is that LC in the process? Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I found it very interesting serving on this task force, and I think that it's important, and I wish, Tom, you could give the increase in the number of women. I think, in the Vietnam War, I know it was very small, and they were primarily nurses, but now it's increased like up to, is it 25%?
Madam Chair, Senator Moss Anderson, it was 7,500 women served in the Vietnam conflict. We have 250,000 and growing in Afghanistan, Iraq.
And it's about time that women came forward to start addressing the issues, because they are unique. And serving on the task force, a number of the women on that task force had stories to tell, and I think the document pretty much reflects their concerns.
Thank you. Any additional comments, colleagues?
No.
Well, thank you so much for coming. I appreciate all your hard work. Let's move on to the report of our reintegration task force. And I believe I have Mr. Burton come up. Good morning.
Good morning, members of the committee, Madam Chair. My name is Mike Burton. I co-chaired, along with Senator Schrader, the Legislative Task Force on Veterans Reintegration. In my other life, I'm Vice Provost at Portland State and Dean of the Extended Campus. I'm a Vietnam vet. Actually, the other day, I found out we can actually, since I actually did my service in Laos, you can actually say that now. The government's admitted that we were actually doing a little combat in that area.
White star.
But I am happy today to provide you with the executive summary of our final report, which will be submitted on October the 1st. We're pretty comfortable with the way we've got the report right now. And I want to thank the members of the task force, particularly the participants we had with it. And I want to thank Director Willis for loaning us Tom Mann, who without Mr. Mann's assistance, really, a lot of this work wouldn't be going forward. He's a superlative person to have on your side. I want to address the first question of what we mean by reintegration. And in our case, we're talking about the first 36 months that someone comes off of active duty and back into the service. In Oregon, most of those people are Guard members. However, we were very careful to address the question of the other service people that come out from the different types of service segments, either from the regular service or from the reserves. And I think, Tom, you said the other day that there's roughly 150 veterans veterans a month who are leaving service and come back into Oregon. So there's a significant number of those folks who we're dealing with. The task force made several key findings that will lead to the recommendations that I'll list for you here in just a minute. These findings include that existing veterans networks exist in various Oregon communities and can provide significant support, but they're not coordinated in their activities. So they're scattered around, they're not really coordinated. There's no organization that follows or does case management for veterans and their families throughout the entire 36-month reintegration period. That first 36 months that we're talking about again. There currently are no coordination, there is no coordination between the statewide reintegration summit, which is something that has been headed up really by the National Guard here, and they do an excellent job with that. And by the way, they don't just serve, again, the Guard, they serve any service people that find those. But there's no coordination between those summits and the local VetNet organizations and working at the grassroots level. So, again, it happens, but it happens on an ad hoc basis. So as you can see, there's a gap between Oregon's current reintegration process and coordinating existing services at the local level and staying in contact with reintegrating veterans throughout that 36 months of the reintegration time. The task force found that veterans actually receive excellent reintegration services throughout their first 6 months of returning to Oregon, particularly if they're in the Guard, and blend back in the communities afterwards, but there's no follow-up beyond that. At the 12 to 24-month period, the task force discovered that some veterans began having serious reintegration issues, everything from unemployment, divorce, self-medication, drug problems, alcohol problems, law enforcement issues, and the suicide rate is significantly higher than it should be on the norm. Unfortunately, nobody in the veterans or reintegration community knows about it unless there is a crisis in the veteran or the veteran's family. In some cases, the judicial system reach out to find help. So the task force is making some recommendations, and we did it in three categories. First, based on conditions, which are existing circumstances that need attention, systemic types of things that affect the processes that affect reintegration, and then those things that are on a continuum, issues that move from the present to the future that are going to be out there regardless of what we do. Under conditions, and these are the recommendations we have in that area, there's six, two of which I believe would require legislative attention. First, request the Oregon National Guard report to the appropriate legislative committees regarding existing military cultural barriers that discourage service members from self-identifying medical, emotional, psychological, and other reintegration concerns, and direct the military department to draft recommendations to eliminate these barriers and report back to the legislature. What we found is that because of the very nature of the culture of the military, that there's a reluctance to report for individual veterans to report what their concerns are. There's two parts to that, really. One is that reluctance is often because of the way that a soldier is told to deal with issues and fuck up and get on with it. And secondly, it's really a matter of trying to go from the top ranks are probably saying, yes, we should do this, but you really get down to the intermediate company level or squadron level, and you have a different attitude that's there. So it's difficult to get through that, and we're looking for ways to try to address that question. At the same time, we should draft a joint memorial urging Congress to have the Pentagon examine military cultural barriers that discourage service members from self-identifying and those same concerns, and direct the Pentagon to draft recommendations to eliminate those barriers. So we need to do this both with our own Guard group and at the national level. I don't know if we're able to show that video. Could we?
It's not gonna.
Can't do it. Okay. I had a 4-minute video I was going to show you, but I think I screwed it up when I sent it down, so I'm technologically impaired. Third, create a no-wrong-door culture within state government whereby all state of Oregon agencies ask their clients if they are veterans, and if so, are provided contact information for the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs and the National Guard Yellow Ribbon Reintegration Team. What we found is that a lot of cases in various state agencies, while they're aware or at least somewhat aware of the potential for a veteran to receive different types of services, that's not the question that comes in. A veteran may go to the housing division, the employment division, looking for something, and if the attaining agency isn't aware of the fact that this person is a veteran and can be directed the right way, then they're in the wrong door, and we want to make sure there isn't any wrong door for vets, that they find their way to the right place. The fourth thing is to draft legislation to address corrections needed in the current veterans preference law. And I can go through that if you want to, but there needs to be some specific, I think we have a placeholder for that particular legislation. Continue to support the 90-day soft landing proposal currently in Congress. Several members of the congressional delegation participated with us in these task forces, and as you know, legislation has been proposed at the federal level to change that 90-day soft landing. What happens is, and by the way, I was talking to a chaplain in the Guard 2 days ago who was on his third deployment, so I was curious when we talk about that 36 month reintegration thing when people are recycling back into active duty within that 36 months. But when they come back, generally what happens is there's a very brief transition period of 5 days between the time that they're on the federal budget, if you would, and the feds are getting off of the budget and back onto the state budget into those different categories. And so that five-day transition period is really what I call death by PowerPoint. They drag these guys into and women into a room and start briefing the hell out of them about their benefits and this sort of thing. And most of these folks are thinking about something else in those first 5 days. Family, getting back to that, getting out of there. And so they usually have a big barrel at the end of the door within the 5 days, and the stuff goes in there and they recycle that. So that a longer period of time that integrates the families of these individuals back into that soft landing and helps them reintegrate would certainly be something recognized as useful. The sixth thing is to fully fund the Department of Veterans Affairs Campus Service Veteran Services Officer Program. As you know, a lot of vets coming back go back into either the community college or the universities. We've had this last biennium, we had five veteran services officers funded out of the out of funds available through the Veterans Department. And those have proved to be extremely valuable components of reintegration, helping the vets who come back in find their services. At Portland State specifically, and a couple of years ago, when I found out that there were only 500 people getting veterans educational benefits out of 25,000 students, I thought something isn't right here. So we got a veteran services officer. I worked out a thing with Director Willis at that time as an experiment. And of course, the first day this person put a table out on the campus, the numbers went up dramatically because the vets just didn't know that that was available to them in a lot of cases, or don't want to approach an office to do that. And so that reintegration aspect, and the most valuable part, by the way, is having a veterans student group on your campus, because there's peers there that will help get that going. But the veteran service officer, of course, is a qualified, certified individual who can help them with those services, and it's extremely valuable to keep that program going in some way. In systems, these are existing processes that affect reintegration. And it's continued to fund at the current level the ODVA's Veterans Emergency Fiscal Assistance, Financial Assistance Program, and refund the Oregon Employment Department, Department's Oregon Veterans Transportation Assistance Fund. I think you heard about that earlier, so that's part of that transportation effort, getting people around. Secondly, mandate to the Oregon University System and the state's community colleges appropriately apply military training and skills for college credit as outlined in the American Council of Education guidelines. Excuse me. I participated in a meeting here this Monday. Senator Schrader had, and Bill Taylor was there facilitating that, and we had represented most of the OUS schools and the community college group to indeed take a look at what the institutions are doing. And they seem to be doing a pretty good a job, I think, of doing the ACE credits to bring in those over across. But there's a second question to that, and that's number three. And that's a direct entry licensing for qualified military occupational specialties. It's not an OUS system. It's not a, thank you, sir. It's not a community. It's a community college or university system. But if somebody is a qualified medic in the services, been in Vietnam, excuse me, been in Afghanistan or Iraq, Iran, those people come out and they have to go through a whole relicensing process to get certified to be an EMT, for example. There's other things. They learn how to drive trucks or electricians. There's a number of trades that they have that rather than being able to try to bring those trades back in without having to go through an extremely difficult licensing process and being able to apply those skills, it prohibits them really from getting jobs. That's a difficult issue to resolve because you have questions that range from, you know, what are the military standards for giving that qualification to what are the state standards. So hopefully the legislature will find some way to have that as a point of discussion during this next session in the interim to take a look at how that might go forward. Also, and this was brought up earlier by the Women's Task Force, encourage the legislature to begin dialogue with TRICARE TriWest regarding expanding a network in rural and remote Oregon to include county mental health and TRICARE providers. TRICARE it depends on what your status is, if you're active or reserve, or if you're under or over 60. When you're 65 or over like I am, then you become eligible for TRICARE for life, and that becomes a supplement to Social Security. That works pretty well. But I live in a metropolitan urban area. If I was to live in a more remote area where there wasn't those providers, then it becomes somewhat of an issue. And I think there needs to be some discussion going with the rural areas. And then finally, continue to integrate outreach and education efforts by the Department of Veterans Affairs and the Oregon National Guard. I think that goes without saying. Other areas, and here's some recommendations again. Create a Veterans Reintegration Coordinator in the Office of the Governor. Difficult, of course, you know, the legislature doesn't tell the governor how to organize his or her office, but that level of concern about reintegration at that level, I think, is something that should be encouraged and hopefully can be created. Create a council for veterans reintegration. We've talked about a veterans council here. That could be part of that, and so we would want to coordinate on that. And then create a volunteer system that quarterly could make contact with reintegrating veterans during a 36-month. That's a follow-up process. The Guard is creating a website that could act to help people access that if indeed they have access to a computer. Recommend the Oregon National Guard Family Program, commend the Oregon National Guard Family Program for its outreach work. I think the legislature, the state really needs to recognize some of the work that's been going on by groups, and these are some groups that have done an outstanding job, including the Veterans Department and the entire National Guard, but these family program is excellent. Continue outreach efforts for the Fort Oregon website. That's the website that'll be up. I don't know what the status of that is. It's up. If you haven't seen that, you might want to go on and look at Fort Oregon. We call it Fort Oregon because we don't have any military. Well, we have a few small sites, but the whole state is, in fact, the military site. So I'm very proud of the work that was done. Again, I want to thank Tom Mann for the help that he gave us and the members of the committee. And we recommend to the task force, we'll have the full report to you by the 1st of October. And we appreciate your attention to this matter, and I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Well, I just want to thank you, Mike, for all your diligent work on this issue. It's been a pleasure to work with you and the rest of the committee. You know, my heart is in this work, but your expertise, as well as Mr. Mann's, as folks who've actually served, I think was instrumental in really helping to frame the issues of this committee as we moved along. So
thank you.
Truly thank you. And I also want to thank you because I think that you were instrumental in the move with I see General Caldwell back there, and other folks from the Governor's Task Force. Paul Evans is here today, too, to really get VSOs on campus. That was a huge, huge step forward, which really, I think, significantly increased the opportunity for veterans to connect in an educational system and get the services that they've earned. So you were really on the forefront of that. Colleagues, for clarification, I'm going to ask Mr. Mann, so could you kind of run through quickly what you think are some of the substantive policy bills that we think we're going to see from this?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, joint memorial to Congress urging the Pentagon to review those issues of medical, emotional, psychological issues that are barriers to self-identifying. Mm-hmm. That would be a joint memorial. There is a placeholder regarding the Veterans Preference Law. There was some confusion. Our agencies received a lot of phone calls from veterans and jurisdictions as to how that's supposed to be implemented, and because of the confusion, we sat down with counsel and hammered out a good bill. We are going to work with your office, Madam Chair, on the No Wrong Door approach. You may recall that during the 2009 session, Executive Order 0909 and House Bill 3104 directed the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs to do some outreach. We found that we've had some success and some areas where we feel that this is still needed to have agencies actually ask the question. We are going to ask the chairs to send a letter to our congressional delegation reiterating the support for the 90-day soft landing. I can tell you in conversations with Senator Wyden's office, that bill is trying to be put into the Defense Authorization Act. As you know, that bill is kind of controversial right now. But if they get that squared away, you may find that the soft landing will be in the Defense Authorization Act. And so beyond that, the other reintegration issues will be discussed with the governor, the incoming governor, with the VA, and continued conversations with our partners at the local grassroots level.
Okay.
Question.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam
Co-Chair Cowan.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. The one item on the first section of recommendations under existing circumstances, number six, fully fund the campus veteran service officer, that one has been added since the last conversation that we had. Is there something that you feel needs to be done legislatively?
Madam Chair, as a committee, If you recall, in the last session, the funding for that was, a one-year funding one biennium funding mechanism that was actually, it uses funds of the department that I think would otherwise could be used elsewhere. So recognizing, and I spent a decade in this body, so I don't understand how difficult some of the financial things are. I think this is going to be looked at to continue that funding. The funding actually will expire, I believe, at the end of the biennium. So, but it's been an extremely valuable program, and you can look at it in a number of ways. First of all, the vets coming on the campus at the community colleges and at the universities are obviously well prepared, highly motivated, and generally succeed in their efforts to complete those programs where other younger people may not. Secondly, that helps them then become a more valuable member of the community. But third, it's also valuable to the state in the sense of the money that comes in, because those are federal resources that are going to become available. So the dollars for the universities and the community colleges as a result of getting those people on board is a heck of a good bargain, if you would. So I think there's a cost-benefit ratio here that ought to be looked at, and hopefully the legislature will be able to work out something either with the department or the department can work out. I shouldn't get into that part of it, but I think that program needs to keep going.
Okay. We'll have some continuing conversation on that.
And we certainly have your phone number, Mike, so hopefully we can talk to you to help out with all your experience as a legislator. Colleagues, any additional questions, any other comments about this task force? All righty.
Thank you very much,
gentlemen. It's a pleasure working with you.
Thanks, all of you, for your work.
I think we're going to have a move here, colleagues, to have another legislative session where the state of Oregon will probably have the largest set of pro-veteran legislation of any other state. I'm going to ask my legislative aide to take a look to see what other states are doing, and I would suspect that we are far ahead. And again, I would like to thank General Caldwell and Paul Evans in the back for actually being the two fellows who initially got me involved in this work to help move things forward. In any case, we're on the final piece of our agenda, and we have Mr. Willis, and we're going to end with a progress report on the siting decision for the second veterans home. And Senator Morissette, hopefully you'll have multiple questions for us. Okay.
Well, Madam Chairs and members of the committee, again, for the record, my name is Jim Willis. I'm director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. And before we get into this final report, I want to comment on something that Chair Schrader said a moment ago about Oregon in a leadership position. I just came from the National Directors Association meeting. It's a meeting where all the state directors of Veterans Affairs meet once a year and discuss current issues. I serve as the National Resolutions Committee Chair, and I wrote, I think, 9 resolutions this time, and I want you to know that 6 of those are based on the actions taken by this body, and they were adopted by the national directors. So without the action that was done by the original Governor's Task Force and these 3 most recent task forces and some of the legislative statutory changes that were made in favor of our veterans, we would not have been in a position to present those national resolutions. So, again, I want to thank you, and that's just proof in the pudding that we are getting it done right, and we're going to continue to do that in the future. So having said that, I've already talked to you about how pleased I am with the work that Tom Mann did, and I think any department director's responsibility has to include finding the best people to do the kind of work that you need done. And one of those people is sitting immediately to my right. He's someone that you will see for some years to come simply because of his responsibilities within the department. And John Osborne will give the report this morning on the second Oregon Veterans Home. You will find that he is articulate and understands very clearly his responsibilities as the construction manager within our department. So thank goodness Salem Hospital was right next door to us where I was able to find him. And I just want to go on record, if they're listening today from Salem Hospital, that you're not getting him back. we're going to keep him. So with that, let me introduce John Osborne. And John, please.
Thank you, Director Willis. Madam Chairs and members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Osborne.
Mr. Osborne, could I just interrupt you one moment? This appears to be a fairly detailed presentation on the construction, per se. There are some other issues around it that I want to make sure that we get time to. So since I'm going to watch the clock a little bit, if we could keep the construction and design piece fairly succinct, I'd appreciate it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will summarize. I won't read the whole.
Thank you very much. I looked at how many pages there were.
It's rather lengthy.
I read ahead.
For the record, my name is John Osborne. I'm the construction manager for the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. This testimony today is kind of a follow-up to the e-board testimony we did in June, and also some we provided at the same time some written answers to questions posed by co-chair Buckley. The USDVA, from a programmatic standpoint, operates in a way that we wished was different, but it's not. It's a matter of putting together veterans homes or constructing veterans homes to take care of the needs of the health needs of aging veterans. We don't they don't give us construction dollars for the assisted living facilities, residential care facilities, adult foster homes, or the community-based facilities, which many communities around the country are going to now. They simply build veterans homes and partner with state's veterans, departments of veterans affairs to build these homes and domiciliaries. The right now all 50 states are doing that, and we have 137 veterans homes around the country. One of the primary reasons this is the issue that related to the desire for veterans to be together revolves around, first of all, the cost to the veteran is significantly less than if they were in a community based skilled nursing facility. Also, it's the camaraderie they have with one another. I think you can see that by the number of organizations related to veterans issues around the country. For our purposes, we are reliant on the USDVA grant process to build these homes, and it's really the only option available to us to do that. And back in 2008, April of 2008, the department submitted a grant proposal to the USDVA, where that grant process works as they supply 65% of the funding for the building of the home. The local jurisdiction where the home in this case in Oregon, the local jurisdiction where the home will be sited provides the 35% matching funds plus the donation of the land. Again, in 2008, the grant request was outlined as a 250 bed facility at a cost of a little over $42 million. This included also Alzheimer's dementia and Alzheimer's beds. And which we have a high demand for, which is our experience in our existing home in the Dalles. We continue to have a high demand for these beds. The Oregon proposal was approved, and we were put on the a priority list. The way these priorities lists work with the USDVA is that you're put on the list once you are approved with them. In our case, it was 122nd at the time. Now the priority list works is as you move along with their checklist and continue to fulfill key components of that checklist. The major two components is have a site and also have your matching funds in place. As you do that, you move up the list, and the best example I think can be the Oregon Transportation Plan, whereas. As you move up the list, your priority list, and you eventually are funded for that. So the same thing works in this case with USDVA. In January 2010, we issued an RFP, and in that RFP, we announced the construction of a second veterans home of approximately 200 skilled nursing beds and 50 Alzheimer's beds. Five jurisdictions, Lynn County, Douglas County, Klamath County, Jackson County, and the city of Coquille all proposed. Later on, we put together an advisor, an evaluation team to look at all the RFPs. We had Denny Nielsen, the former vice president of Salem Hospital, John Mangus, former director of Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, who oversaw the construction of the first veterans home in Oregon. Governor's Advisory Committee to Director of Veterans Affairs, member Tino Ornelas, and ODVA Chief Financial Officer Bruce Willis, ODVA's ODVA's Facilities Administrator Bruce Craig, and myself. The director told us that we were going to operate separately from his office, so the director would not be seen as any involvement in the citing of the recommendation, and there would be no perceived conflict of interest there. As we were moving through the process, I was in contact with USDVA and also Assistant Attorney General for the department to make sure we were following the process to the letter of the law. In those conversations with USDVA, they too were looking at reviewing and changing the way they were going to start building veterans homes around the country. They'd gone from these large, long hallway style veteran home facilities, much like a hospital is today, to the small house model. And they were encouraging all applicants for funding to review their initial application and move in that direction. The committee reviewed this. We thought this was the way to go. During our discussions, determined that to begin with, we would build 100 to 150 beds, with the option as needed to continue to add to that location more beds if needed, up to 250 beds. Okay.
Senior moment here.
Yeah. Whoa.
Dr. Keith Warner about a stroke. I was thinking what happened.
Okay, we're back now.
Okay.
We're
back. During the site visits, our evaluation team asked all the applicants if modifying the initial size from 250 beds to 150 small house model would in any way affect their interest in proposing or their previously submitted proposal. All five jurisdictions so responded that while they were not affecting their interest or proposal, they were interested in how much it would affect the cost. Each jurisdiction was pleased to learn that it would reduce the overall cost of construction, thus lowering the 35% match they were required to provide. Now, in hindsight, if we were to do anything better and improve that process, it would be to not document these verbal communications between ourselves, ODVA, and the RFP applicants. We feel we've met the legal standard, but that during this also, it would be preferable for everyone to have received these amendments in writing to eliminate any confusion. Once the site visits were completed, the team began rating all the applications on a series of criteria. It is important to know that each jurisdiction met the requirement for local matching funds by agreeing to fund a 35% match. A member voiced a concern that an applicant knew if they had known that the project was only 150 beds, they may have had a better position regarding their matching funds. However, because every applicant met the matching fund criteria, there was no advantage lost. The site evaluation team, made its recommendation to the director that Lynn County be the site for the second home. Douglas County was ranked second, Jackson County was ranked third, Klamath fourth, and the city of Coquille fifth. The director agreed with the recommendation, and the department started work on a public announcement. Here again, this is the second area the department could have done a better job. The idea was to make the local to make the official announcement in the winning community and send out statewide press releases at the same time as the announcement. Erringly, we did not provide the advanced notice to legislative leaders. Further, the press release was thought to have been sent to both congressional delegations and all members of the legislature as part of the distribution, actually was not. We were poor partners with our elected officials and in the release of this information. Aftermath of this announcement led to appeals filed by Jackson and Klamath counties. They indicated the appeal was based on the change from a 250-bed home to 150 beds, and that the director had awarded a third veterans home to Roseburg, which was not in the RFP. The applicants were orally notified. Let me back up. During our testimony here, the RFP states that at the time of the RFP, the plan was to build 250 skilled nursing beds and 50 Alzheimer's beds. This was a perspective based on the information on hand at the time the RFP was announced. Each applicant was orally notified of the potential of moving the small house model to include 100 to 150 beds with the perspective of adding additional beds as the need arose. Each applicant assured us at the time that this was not a problem, that they would happily move forward with it, and while we offered them to produce any additional information they thought we might need to make our decision, we received none. Another source of confusion and missing information regarding the third home related to the press release. The press release, I'll read that, what was in that press release. Originally slated to be 250-bed facility, the site evaluation committee recommended that the second veterans home be 150 beds and that the third veterans home be built in Roseburg to cover Oregon's southwest region. ODVA will need legislative approval to build a third veterans home. There was no intention to subvert the system, as evidenced by the note noting that the legislature would have to get approval for a third home. In private conversations with Co-Chair Buckley, the director said that he was willing to issue a new RFP for a third home should legislative approval for construction be approved. No way was this trying to subvert the system. It was just thought that since Douglas was the second-ranking winner in the RFP process, it seemed to make sense to have that as the next site for the second veterans home with legislative approval. I guess in closing, I would just say that we stand by our evaluation process with the improvements I just talked about. We could have done it better, and we are convinced, though, that Linn County is the best choice for the location of the second veterans home. A small house model is the best direction to provide the finest care to our Oregon veterans. It'll bring about 250 construction jobs, about 200 permanent jobs at the home itself, and untold jobs, number of jobs to the local community in support of the home. We look forward to continuing our work with USDVA, Linn County, and the legislature as we progress, and I'd be happy to answer any questions at this time.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Madam Chair. we've got two folks. How about Senator Morissette?
Let's take Senator Morissette.
My list is not.
Linn County is in my district, which is fine. I'm talking about the hospital that's supposed to come to Lane County. Springfield Peace Health was awarded that contract, apparently, but now they're talking about moving it over to a different location. It's not this program, so no. We can talk about that later, but I'm kind of curious about where we are with that, because they did select the site, and then they seem to be changing their mind going to another location.
Madam Chair, I know about that situation. I'll be happy to meet with the senator offline and discuss that.
So it is different than this.
Yeah, it is.
It is different. Totally different. Yes.
So we are okay having a conversation and moving on to this conversation. My colleague, Representative Cowan,
who's been making a big, long list.
That's okay, I know. I've watched.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I have two directions that I want to lay out some questions and conversations, and hopefully will then leave room for others who might want to weigh in. First of all, you are absolutely correct in your suggestion that the communication in this whole thing was less than stellar. We could have perhaps forestalled a great deal of the angst that resulted had we had better communication from the beginning. So I agree. We agree on that issue. The issue of why there were some changes in the thinking from this size to this size to this size, it all still amounts to building new skilled nursing places to put people in one place, and flies totally in the face of community-based long-term care for seniors and people with physical disabilities that we've been working on in the state of Oregon for every other Oregonian, and so that I will get back to that issue. But I'm not the attorney, but it seems to me when you put out an RFP for this design and then you decide in the course of that conversation that we're going to have some other design and different sizes and different matching fund requirements and all of those kinds of things, help me understand how it's appropriate to have just a conversation with the four bidding entities about whether they'd be okay with that, rather than a new RFP process that would allow any other entities who might be able to meet the specifications of a smaller facility and a smaller matching grant or matching funds, but perhaps didn't apply because of the initial RFP descriptions.
Madam Chair, one of the reasons we didn't go back to another RFP was the work we'd already put in. We felt that we had numerous calls from smaller jurisdictions around the state asking about this process and what kind of money they were looking for. Right now our design is somewhere around 150 beds. That amount decreased by about $10 million. So we're looking at about $32 million for this next home in Lebanon. As far as issuing a new RFP, it was our judgment that we didn't think any of these smaller communities would have applied anyway. Places like Baker City and Astoria, we had calls from Lincoln City. Coming up with that kind of money just didn't seem in the ballpark for them. They initially talked to us about it. I told them at the time that we looked at that the funding and the land would be both things they would have to provide, and it was just our judgment at the time it wasn't necessary.
I understand that there are some legal challenges moving forward, and I don't want to get into the middle of those here, so we'll leave it at that. And I don't particularly want to get today into which place is the best. The siting issues are really not what's before us today. But as I've looked at the proposals, the matching fund promise from any of the entities that are on there involves the passage of a local levy. Now, one of them is in the form of a interdepartmental loan that still is, the plan is that it will be repaid with a successful passage of a local levy. So my question is, what happens to their application if their levy should not be successful?
Typically what would happen is that we would move down the list to the second site that was recommended, and you would move forward that way. However, we've heard from Linn County, they've indicated if the levy doesn't pass, they are still planning on spending those dollars for the veterans' home. They have authority to do it, and in any case, they are going to move forward with providing the matching funds to the ODVA and to move forward with this process. One of the other things that Linn County did was to do a survey during our visit to them. They provided us with a polling and a survey they'd done within the county to see what kind of support the A option levy would garner. And it was overwhelmingly in support of that option levy.
When was that survey done?
The exact date, I'd have to...
Well, approximately how long ago?
It would probably, see, we met, it would have probably been done the early part of this year, January, February.
Okay. And that's on this November's?
That is correct, yes.
Okay.
Madam Chair, if I might offer something?
Yes, please.
Okay. I'm a little confused about something you said a moment ago about continuing legal challenges.
My impression was that there were challenges filed by some of the non-successful entities. Maybe I'm incorrect.
There were. It was an appeal, and the appeal was addressed and answered and is now concluded.
Okay, great.
So there are no continuing legal
challenges. Thank you for that clarity.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
Now, I'd like to get to my primary issue here. As I've researched this a little bit, and as most everyone here knows, community-based long-term care for seniors is probably my passion above all else in this legislative body. So to have you guys wanting to go out and build big nursing home warehouses flies in the face of everything else I'm doing in this session. And I've been wrestling with that as this thing sort of moved along, kinda, and now I've come to the conclusion that I can't live with the differences. So in the process, I've asked, why is that? Why can't we put a much lower cost amount of money into helping veterans stay in their home communities in lower cost kinds of care, specifically with in-home care, in assisted living facilities, residential care, or adult foster homes? Those are the primary areas that I'm talking about here. And the answer that I get is because ODVA or the Veterans Department won't pay for that. Well, we've done a lot of memorials, and we've worked with our congressional delegation, and we've talked to a lot of folks about how we maybe need to change some things that might be just a bit, with apologies, antiquated in the veteran system. I understand that in part of your presentation you talked about a desire to live together with people of similar experiences, and you refer that there's a percentage of veterans who might wish that. That may very well be. I would certainly acknowledge that and agree. It would be interesting a little bit to know what those percentages are, as opposed to the percentage that might wish to stay in their home communities close to family and friends and that sort of thing. We have no idea, but I think that calls into the question the need for 900 beds, which we've been living with. So then I got some documentation that I was just reviewing yesterday from the Veterans Health Administration overview on Aging Network and Veterans Health Administration Partnerships and Opportunities. And one of their PowerPoint slides said, VHA philosophy for long-term care. Provide care in the least restrictive environment, whenever possible in home and community-based settings. Nursing home care should be reserved for situations in which the veteran can no longer be safely maintained in the home. Doggone, that looks a lot like Oregon's plan for long-term care for seniors and people with disabilities. And there was some reference in there about how those payments were made, and it may be a separate waiver grant process, whatever it is that we need to look at. So at this point in time, I'm weighing between my options. I am going to prepare a joint memorial to Congress saying if this really is the case within VA, then they need to start changing how they pay for long-term care. But if there's something that's statutorily more than that that we could do that would make it possible for you to take advantage of some improved and more current thinking, before we build three facilities, can't we please talk about this? That's my question.
Well, Madam Chair, certainly we can. And let me say to you that I strongly favor in-home care as the number one option.
Community-based for care. Community, you don't always have
well,
to stay
I know.
In your
okay.
home.
Okay, community-based care. I strongly favor that. But if the diagnosis is that the individual needs skilled nursing full-time, there's needs to be a conversation about what that means versus what the community facility is willing to offer. And certainly in-home care, which usually does not measure to full-level skilled nursing. So that's an issue we just have to address. The other thing we have to address...
Before you move beyond
sure.
that, let me ask a question.
Mm-hmm.
In your survey that told you that you needed 900 beds, did that say that all of those individuals needed skilled nursing placement? Or
Madam
that they
Chair,
were going
no,
to need some
no,
sort of care?
Not. It did not. Some of them were needing domiciliary care, and then some needed full nursing. And that wasn't our survey. That's a U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs survey. And I think the reason they do that survey is because they then can monitor the number of beds a state can have in terms of long, skilled nursing in the model that we're talking about. So I think to just recap where you are and where we are, or at least where I am as director, I agree with you about the in-home care. I agree with you about the community care. And I think that the thing we have to be very cautious about is a representation that it's less expensive. In some cases, in-home care is more expensive than skilled nursing care in a veterans home. And I've seen the statistics, and I can show those to you or get them to you so you'll be able to do a comparison. And then it's about a scale of economics in terms of the size of the community-based care as to which one pencils out. And then finally, for those veterans who do not have a home to have in-home care in, the veterans home provides a place where they can live in comfort and in good medical care and dignity for the rest of their life. And finally, I would just point out that in John's testimony this morning, you heard the term small house model, and I want to talk to you about just a second, so it'll make you feel a little better, I hope, about veterans homes versus the large institutional facilities that you're used to seeing in the past. We didn't get a chance to go over the slide that was up, but let me just tell you that in the future, we use small house concepts, which means the VA won't accept any kind of a wing on one of those homes that has more than 14 beds. So that then becomes what we call a neighborhood. And then each of those 14-bed facilities becomes a community when they're lumped together, like if there were three of them. And then that community makes up the entire population. The administration is kept separate from that. And then there are individual, and I, maybe you did see it when the slide was up there, there's individual courtyards for each of those communities within the neighborhood. So it's based on how close when we can we get it to the kind of home they lived in before they came. And the experience that the VA has had and that some of my fellow state directors who've already built that model in two states that I'm aware of, is that they're much happier in that environment than in a institutional setting with the long, long hallways and you're in your ward and a food cart comes and so on, as opposed to these new facilities where the food's made right on the spot and they eat right there like they do at home. So we need to have more conversations about what this new model looks like. Because I think there's some, not misunderstanding, there's just lack of knowledge within this body about where we're trying to go and the kind of model that we're going to use. Now, having said that, Madam Chair, I'm really supportive of the joint memorial about community care. I wish we had that option with the federal VA in terms of their funding stream, even though they have said publicly, as a matter of policy, that, and you just read it, that they also like the in-home home care when it can happen, and other alternatives. But they haven't said to us what those alternatives are. So, anyway.
Thank you for your comments. The question of misunderstanding or lack of knowledge, I think, probably is a two-way street.
Clearly.
Here, and I am fully supportive of the concept of a small cottage versus a dormitory institution. That still isn't being cared for in your home community. Now, I will acknowledge that if an individual has no home and does not have an established network of natural caregivers, friends, family, or whatever other social connections in a community, then it's very possible that some sort of a residential facility is the most appropriate placement. And in that case, a small cottage would be far and away more preferable.
Sure.
But I think that the statistics that you're working on really need to be examined more closely for Oregon veterans and their current situation, and whether there's a desire for those individuals to stay in their home community where they do have established relationships, and that there are opportunities for placement. I heard very clearly what you said, that USDVA doesn't provide grant construction money for assisted living facilities, residential care facilities, adult foster homes, or any other community-based facility. But the fact is that those facilities exist in our communities, and they would be less costly to the Veterans Department to help an individual live in existing facilities within their own home community than to cover the cost. Now, I don't know what the VA figures their cost per bed per day in a skilled nursing facility is. That will be an interesting number to get. But I do know what those numbers are from, say, Department of Human Services here in Oregon, as to what it costs us to maintain a Medicaid individual in a skilled nursing facility versus assisted living facility, residential care, adult foster care, or in-home care. And I can tell you based on those numbers that I would highly question that in-home care is more expensive than a skilled nursing facility. But where the difference in that comparative number comes in is what level of care does one need in terms of in-home care. If someone needs 24/7 outside caregiver in their home, then very possibly that's correct. If someone can safely and comfortably continue to live in their own home with a couple, 3 hours a day of some kind of assistance, then that absolutely is not correct. So I'm just saying that I think it's time for us to step back and look a great deal more seriously on what are the needs and preferences and the direction that we want to go in Oregon caring for our aging veterans before we move full steam ahead with building anywhere from 1 to 3 new facilities.
Well, Madam Chair, we'll be happy to provide you with that information.
I guess that probably wasn't a question. Please, are there any other questions?
I think Senator Boquist has a comment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jim, just recap briefly for me, and you've done this in at least 3 sessions ago. How much general fund is used to support the present hospital?
None.
And how much general fund would be used to support this hospital?
None.
And if we put the brakes on right now and say, stop, we're not going to build the existing facility, what happens? We lose the grant?
Well, certainly we'll lose the grant.
Thank you. That's good, too.
Okay.
Yes, Senator Morrison.
What are the other two states that have, which other two states that have this kind of facility?
Madam Chair and Senator Morissette, it is Arizona and Alabama. And the one you saw on the slide there was Pell City, Alabama, which is currently just starting to be constructed.
Okay, I know Representative Boone has a question.
Thank you. I just have a quick question about, is it possible for, in these homes for veterans, is it possible to partner with a private entity, like a company that builds homes for seniors in any case? You know, there are companies who build and operate these things, and I just wondered if that's a possibility for a private contractor to partner and with it, and I don't know how the operation would go, but.
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Boone, that's how ours does operate.
Oh, okay.
It is operated by a private company under a contract to us, and then we do quality control oversight, and we have two staff on site that represent the interests of the state.
I probably wasn't paying attention.
Yeah, no, that's okay, okay. Sure.
Okay, colleagues, any additional questions or comments right now? All righty, it seems as if we will actually be done 10 minutes early. I want to thank you gentlemen for coming.
Thank you for inviting me.
You bet. And I also want to say I want to thank Bill Taylor. I think we've done a lot of productive work. And Bill, I'm hopeful that you can get an email out to us. I know that Representative Cowan has been very diligent in keeping track on her notepad of some of the legislative concepts, and I'd like to get an email out to all of us, and hopefully both of you can work together. I just went through all my paper and yellowed them out, which means I will probably never find them again, but in any case, if we could kind of just get an email out of where we are with the concept sooner than later, and then my anticipation, I think we're having separate meetings in December. And I will say, at least, thank you, Co-Chair Cowan. It's been wonderful working with you.
It's been fun.
It's been fun. In December, my expectation would be to officially accept the reports, go through the legislative concepts that have kind of emerged from this, you know, from the reports that we've done from the task force, and then I will have some invited testimony from folks who've been actually doing some hands-on work with our veterans, and they've asked to come numerous times. I keep putting them off, but I'm hopeful that in December we'd have a little bit of time to let some folks talk about what they've done and actually have an opportunity for us to thank them. So with that, thank you, everyone, and we will officially adjourn unless there are any questions.
Thank you.
And we are adjourned as well. All right.